Welcome to the Omfit Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Omfit DMI Podcast with AWS Institute. On the Omfit DMI Podcast, we discuss key trends and new developments in innovation and the policy, technology and regulatory challenges in all things related to digital finance. I'm Katie Ann Wilson from Omfit, and I'm very pleased to be joined by David McKee, Principal Technology Advisor at Amazon Web Services, and Craig Boyswich, Principal Architect at Payments Calendar. It's my great pleasure to welcome you both. So today, we've got a great task ahead of us. We're going to talk about CBDC implementation models, exploring the division of labor between central banks and intermediaries, challenges of a two-tier model, and how the central bank can incentivize adoption when this disruption of business models is going to take place. Now, over the last year or so, I think we've seen the CBDC debate move on. We've gone beyond direct CBDC accounts with central banks. People are looking towards this two-tier model. The binary debate of DLT versus non-DLT has become slightly more complicated. We're looking at different features with technology. So I think this brings us to a great point where we can start focusing on the implementation more specifically and the respective roles within that, as the topic of this podcast suggests. So David, I'd love to get your thoughts first and start with you. If we're looking at this two-tier retail CBDC model, which a lot of the central banks seem to be going for, what would the division of labor between central banks and commercial banks and payment service providers look like?
Hi, thank you, Katie Ann. That's a great question to start with. So I think some parts of the answer are fairly clear, fairly easy. So obviously the central bank is always going to have responsibility for managing the issuance of minting of CBDC. And the other extreme, it's accepted that the private sector should be managing the day-to-day contact with individual users, citizens and businesses, and brokering access to the CBDC system to execute transactions and provide value-added services. But where there are still quite a lively debate and questions is in the role of the private sector in supporting running the CBDC system itself. In other words, a role in managing parts of the ledger for the CBDC system, or helping in the processing of transactions. So those questions are as much about policy drivers as they are about technology. And this is an area where policy and technology are really closely linked. So for example, in a DLT solution, maybe based on blockchain, it's possible for commercial banks to have a special role in operating nodes in the blockchain network. And that might be attractive in order to help preserve a special role for them in the CBDC world, which I guess we'll come on to in a little bit. Or in some solutions, such as the intermediated model as described by the Bank for International Settlements, there's a special role for the private sector in managing the individual CBDC accounts for users. And the central, if you like, CBDC system only records the overall balances of the commercial banks or other PSPs themselves. And again, you know, from a policy point of view, there may be some attractions of that kind of model, because it limits the extent that information is shared centrally with the central bank, and privacy concerns are really important. So I think there are a number of questions still open, and answering those questions are really crucial for central banks in their CBDC programs.
Thank you for that. I think you're completely right. The central bank managing the wholesale balances seems to be optimal at the moment, or that seems to be where the trends are going. Craig, just to bring you in here, we know that digital identity is a huge part of this division of labor. and we can hear, you know, India, we've seen India build its payment system on its national identity scheme. Sweden, we know, has a good identity scheme, not national, but a bank one. And payments really is digital identity plus accounting. And I think accounting probably is the hard part. So how does identity fit into what David's just described? And do you think central banks will be happy with these tools available to commercial banks already, KYC, et cetera? How will this play out? And can we even have a CBDC without a digital ID?
I mean, I've posited that, you know, digital ID is potentially a, you know, a good cornerstone for any central bank digital currency, anything moving into pure digital payments and digital currency. Identity is very key. You know, certainly if there's any sort of, you know, plausible deniability in activity with a wallet or an account in a digital context, you know, the entire construct really starts to crumble. So, yeah, I mean, we've seen different approaches to digital identity, whether it's bank-based or government-based. Different jurisdictions will obviously have different challenges. You know, Estonia is another good example of a national digital ID program that can be easily tied into the delivery of digital currency. And I think, you know, as we were talking about the wholesale retail differences, I think, you know, there's also opportunity within the retail side of a digital currency implementation that it may not necessarily be a single ledger. And I think if there's an opportunity to have, you know, each direct participant bank, you know, kind of operating their own retail ledger for the customers, everything on those banks, that means that, you know, sort of bank-based identity may be of big value in the retail side. But, you know, obviously a national identity infrastructure should be a priority for most jurisdictions anyways.
But it won't be a fundamental prerequisite. For example, do you think we could have a digital euro without ID?
I think there's a lot more challenges. And, you know, like I said, if you get into a realm of plausible deniability of transactions within the digital ecosystem, then that is where that digital ecosystem will collapse. I mean, because why would I agree that I created any transaction if there's plausible deniability that I made the transaction?
Right, exactly. I mean, there has to be some management of identity, some management of authentication. Mm-hmm. And of course, there has to be some kind of KYC service and standards imposed in order to control anti-money laundering, for example. But the form that takes is very much up for grabs. It doesn't have to be based on a national identity scheme. Mm-hmm. And the identities don't necessarily have to be shared beyond the individual, you know, commercial bank or payment service provider that each user is working with. So I think it's those levers that are more open to debate.
Mm. Exactly. I mean, we could do a whole other podcast on digital identity, so I won't spend too much time on it. But I just wanted to get both of your thoughts, or I mean, Craig, maybe considering that you're representing Payments Canada here, is there any geographical differences you think that will come up here? I'm based in the UK, and we know that the Bank of England is quite open to payment service providers getting access to the central bank balance sheet. This is different in Europe. So in terms of these, you know, providers having an increased role with the central bank and in the retail sphere, do you see any differences here? Do you think there will be a different approach?
Yeah, you know, it creates a change in the way that liquidity is applied to the ecosystem, mostly. And it also opens that option for what we call synthetic central bank digital currencies, which is really allowing, you know, what we see as stable coins in the crypto space today to become part of that central bank ledger and access to central bank liquidity, as an option in lieu of stockpiling, you know, currency or, you know, any other sort of backing to a stable coin. So those are some of the big differences that we see and some of the options that are created by opening that door.
And there is different receptions to that based on where where you're based. I think the US has been quite clear on its approach to stable coins at the moment. It's creating quite a hard line. Whereas we heard John Cunliffe quite recently discuss that he can see as a potential role for stablecoins in the lead up to CBDC, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a big part of it is that ability to transition from being a stablecoin to a synthetic CBDC, where you have basically central bank backing of that stablecoin.
Certainly. So, David, just to go back to the model that we were looking at and that you mentioned earlier, what are the challenges with this approach that I guess are cross-country that would apply to most regions that are looking at this? We know the benefits of this because we know that the direct account with the central banks has a high likelihood of defunding the bank. So I would like to really touch upon some of the challenges that we're seeing with this optimum two-tier model where the intermediaries play a bigger role. What will the effects be on the ecosystem of retail payments?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned one, which is the potential for either central bank digital currencies or stable coins to effectively disintermediate the commercial banks. In other words, for commercial bank accounts to shrink a little bit. And that there's obviously questions that central bankers are considering there, and it brings open things like enforcing limits on how much CBDC people can hold, or possibly having some kind of tiered interest rates or kind of negative interest rates to disincentivize people from holding too much CBDC. And actually, you know, then if you get into those questions, there's a link back to what we were discussing a moment ago, this question about identity. Because if you want to impose a limit on how much CBDC any individual can hold, then you need some way of keeping track of the total amount of CBDC that they have across what could be, you know, multiple separate accounts. And then begin to think, well, does that require some kind of disclosure and some kind of coordinated management of identity so you can see what the totals are? So that's one challenge. And then kind of building on that again and sticking with this question about identity and managing identity. I mean, there's another question which links to identity, which is maybe more relevant to some countries rather than others. And that's the ability to be able to use CBDC to provide certain kinds of centralized services that, you know, have benefits to citizens. So, for example, in some emerging market economies, it may be a priority to provide some kind of centralized fraud detection or anti-money laundering, or to use central bank digital currency as a means for direct financial support to citizens. And that has an implication again on identity, because that would then maybe require you to have more centralized management of identity so that the central bank and the government can provide those services.
I mean, yeah, that would be fascinating if emerging markets could use this to rein in corruption. Craig, what are your thoughts on this, on these points, and David's points that he just raised?
Yeah, and absolutely, that's one of the big levers in the design of a central bank digital currency, is the degree of, you know, privacy and transactional disclosure that is kind of built into the ecosystem. You know, you probably, you know, don't want to swing so far that, you know, every transaction that you perform is you know, sort of in the public sphere necessarily, but at the same time you want to make sure that you have transactional traceability. And, you know, that in the case that if a financial operator is looking at tracing transactions and connecting the dots for potential fraud or potential misuse of currency, that they have the ability to do that.
Mm. And I think, again, some countries would worry about this more than others. The ECB was very concerned, or the public consultation showed that the ECB was extremely concerned about this privacy element and the option that central banks could see the transactions. But just wanted to ask you, with on the limits that David mentioned, do you think that this could be an issue for consumer adoption, these kind of limits?
It is possible. When you look at the way that, you know, again, if you sort of draw parallels between what we see in the usage of cryptocurrency today to the way that central bank digital currencies may work in the future, where, you know, you could have a sizable sum of money sitting in a digital wallet that's either on your phone or in the cloud, which, you know, creates a tremendous amount of portability of currency that you could basically take with you in and out of any given jurisdiction with impunity. You know, if you're going to create, you know, a wallet that has limits on the amount of money that you can have for that portability, and that the rest of your currency has to be assigned to a bank managed wallet, you know, there's different things that may need to happen in the ecosystem in order to manage some of those issues.
Yeah, right. I agree with you, Craig. And you kind of touched on yet another question about the role of the private sector, you know, to what extent we do, you know, we mentioned that maybe the private sector is responsible for KYC, and maybe they're responsible for managing identity and managing access, but to what extent are they also helping users by managing their credentials and, you know, what we call custodial wallets? To what extent do individuals have freedom to move between different payment service providers, or to what extent are they tied to a specific one?
I mean, if the proposition of the CBDC isn't value added enough with that kind of usability, it could just fail, which I think is another key concern for central banks. And I mean, just moving on to, I suppose, the business interest in adopting this, we just touched upon the consumers and the value added for them. But I think a key issue for central banks is developing a business model that is just successful enough to encourage intermediaries to use it and to promote it and consumers to adopt it without being too successful that it stifles competition and innovation. So how do you think central banks should go about ensuring intermediaries adopt this? What do they need to do? David?
Yeah. So there's a clear need for the private sector and for some of the existing service providers in the ecosystem that runs retail payments now to pick up the ball, really, and to help the central banks to roll out CBDC and to make it happen. It's not something that you know, the central bank can do on their own. And so creating the right conditions that make it attractive for those existing providers to play a role is key, and to do that in a way which allows them to, as simply and kind of efficiently as possible, adapt their existing services and map them onto a central bank digital currency world, whether that's existing providers of merchant services, so the devices that capture transactions in shops and stores, to payment gateway providers that are currently, you know, there's an enormous amount of innovation in that area, to, for example, capture transactions online and provide workflow and value add services. You know, how can they be adapted so that they work it on CBDC rails? So the challenge for the central banks is to obviously work closely with the private sector, to consult with them, and to define a set of protocols, standards, and a regulatory framework which define these roles in the CBDC world and make it as easy as possible for existing players and new players to come in and to work together, competing on a level playing field.
Please.
Yeah, I agree with David. I mean, you know, I think the big thing that central banks need to contend with is the sheer scale of what would need to be delivered, you know, for a lot of countries to manage their entire payments ecosystem using digital currency. And so I think for that, you know, the central banks need to be very clear on what those roles are for the different participants in the economy. So, you know, what do principal banks do? What do other financial services agencies do? What do the payment service players do? And how do they contribute to the overall stability of the digital currency ecosystem and the continued operations of it?
Yeah. And of course, central banks have experience in this. You know, in many countries, the success of open banking, it provides a template, right? And the way that they've experimented with regulatory sandboxes and in some cases creating open innovation platforms that allow the private sector to come in a kind of trusted execution environment, work with synthetic data, and collaborate with central banks in their CBDC programs. I mean, that's part of the answer, I think. It's very much about kind of opening up to the private sector to help kind of form this vision.
I think that the incentive structures are being worked out as we speak. I know that when we last spoke to the Riksbank, this was top of their agenda. And I think everything you've touched upon would be extremely valuable for them to take into account. I mean, just while we're talking, I think we mentioned the usage of this, the interoperability. I would just like to finally ask you both how we can envision this cross-border. The CBDC outside of its native jurisdiction is still unclear, but it's obviously got a really clear use case in cross-border payments. So I just love to get both your thoughts on how central banks can begin thinking about this really, really impossible task, well, hopefully not impossible, but challenging task of interoperability of different CBDCs cross-border. Craig, why don't you take us off first?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, obviously there is a tremendous amount of work just within the current ecosystems around cross-border payments, you know, the interconnection of faster payment systems. And I think, you know, a lot of that is going to probably contribute into the policies of cross-border central bank digital currency. You know, again, there's some extra wrinkles with CBDC in that, you know, you can have multi-currency wallets. So it should be easier for people to potentially hold multiple different central bank digital currencies within the same wallet, use similar exchange mechanisms that we have today in order to kind of move different currencies between the different, you know, accounts within that wallet. So, you know, there's probably some things that become a lot easier, but then it becomes, you know, how do you manage that from a policy perspective and a monetary policy perspective to make sure that you sort of protect the usage of currency globally?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I mean, I guess it's probably worth saying, when you look at the Financial Stability Board and the roadmap for cross-border payments, we're kind of in the middle of the work stream led by Bank for International Settlements, Innovation Hub and CPMI and the World Bank and IMF, looking at this problem from an international perspective. And that probably makes sense, right? There's been some great work by the individual national central banks on pilots and POCs in this space. And quite rightly, this international group is surveying those. But I think, from my perspective, I wouldn't kind of dream of telling them what the right answer is. I'm sure that the right people are looking at this problem and will be watching with interest when they produce some reports on findings later in 2022.
Yeah, and I'm sure they would do increasingly stakeholder engagement for those. And hopefully we can address some of the frictions like data. I think there needs to be a design which allows the quick movement of rich data. Otherwise, I think we're back to the old frictions of the current system. But I mean, this has all been fascinating. We've touched upon so many issues, identity, business models, competition. architecture, ledgers. I think there's so much more to go from here, but thank you so much for your time today. This has been absolutely fascinating. For our listeners, please do subscribe to our OnFIF podcasts. We're on Spotify, on iTunes. We release DMI podcasts every 2 weeks or so. Thank you, Craig and David.
Thank you for listening to the OnFIF podcast.